on his first address on the 1st of John chapter 3 verses 1 to 12. Brother John, please.
My most dearly beloved brothers and sisters in the hope we share. In my experience in the truth, there have been many times where I felt totally inadequate and unable really to deal fully with the subject, and never more so than this evening. This epistle of John is one of the deepest and most wonderful studies that we could possibly make. And in the short period of time we've got this evening together, we're not going to get very far. To do the subject justice, we would most probably need to spend an evening on each verse as they occur. And that, of course, is something we cannot do. So this evening, it will most probably be very disjointed. I will be trying to explain to you thoughts which have taken me most probably 30 years to clarify, and I've got to try to say them in two or three words. So, God willing, we will be in agreement, and if we're not, please ask. Show me where I've got it wrong, if I have. Because the subject we have to consider commences with one simple word. And our considerations start with the word behold. Now, I've never yet been able to get into the mind of the translators as to why they should use different English words for the same original Greek word. The original Greek word we have here is the word eido. And that word, when I first found it and looked it up in the concordance, said it occurs 666 times. Now, if we need to take note then, perhaps it's serious. It's serious that we consider what the apostle is saying to us. He says, behold. Well, this word, eido, actually is one which is extremely important to us. And if you'll come with me to the book of Revelation, the second chapter, and verse 2. Now this is repeated seven times. On seven occasions, the Spirit moves the apostle to write, I know thy works. If we were taking it from John's epistle, he says, behold thy works. It's the same word. And therefore this word know is something which he has as an awareness. We are called upon to have an awareness. And therefore he says, I know thy works and thy labour and thy patience, and how thou canst not bear them which are evil, and thou hast tried them which say they are prophets and are not, and hast found them liars. And that was a commendation. Now, if you follow the sort of mind that I have, I ask myself a very simple question. The question is, how does he know? How is it, my beloved brothers and sisters, we are to behold? Well, verse 1 tells us. He says, unto the angel of the ecclesia in Ephesus write, these things saith he that holdeth the seven stars in his right hand, who walketh in the midst of the seven golden lampstands. And how often do we speak one to another, and we talk about where two or three are gathered together, there am I in the midst. So he knows by experience. And that's what behold means here. He is charging us with this challenge. Do you know by experience? Is it your experience that we should follow these words? And he says, behold, what manner of love. Just one small four-letter word. Love. And we abuse it and we misuse it. And we never, ever, in my estimation, ever come to a complete and pure understanding of what he's telling us. What manner? That word manner means quality. It's the quality of that love. Behold, come to know by experience the quality of love the Father has bestowed upon us. Do you ever, my beloved sisters, get in any sort of emotional state? Do the words, when you read them, do the expositions we hear, the exhortations that guide us, do they actually make us feel? Do we go from somewhere with that remembrance, something which makes us shake, something which makes us feel? Because that's what this should do. And you can understand then why I feel so inadequate in trying to express to you the way it makes me feel. Because this is love that we are to consider. So, what is love? What is its quality? Well, first and foremost, it has two aspects. One, yes, the manner and quality of love that he has bestowed upon us. But what's the quality of love we bestow on one another? Does it actually mean something? Does it make us feel the wonder of the love that was bestowed upon us? There are so many passages which we should consider. There are so many we should go to. But will it suffice if we go back to the Gospel of John and chapter 15? Now, I say there are many places we could go. There are most probably an infinite number of passages we could consider. So there's the time factor. But there is a reason why we should go to this one. In John 15 and verse 12 it says, this is my commandment, that ye love one another as I have loved you. Behold what manner of love. And it's a commandment, not just that we should be the recipients of the quality of love extended to us, but we should be the dispensers of the same. One to the other. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. For his friends. That's based on the other word for love. That's philia. There's the basis for your friendship. Now, agape love is one that we do by commandment, irrespective. We love our enemies. But philia, my beloved and sisters, is slightly different. Filial love is retrospective and reactive to oneself. It comes back. It's like casting your bread upon the waters. We do not do it just willy-nilly. It comes back. And that love comes back in this principle of the manner of love that has been bestowed upon us. That Christ was prepared to die. But we are only his friends. It only comes back to us if we do the same one to the other. And therefore he says, ye are my friends if ye do whatsoever I command you. So our obedience manifests the quality of love. that manner. Do we really and sincerely get down to the principles of love? I know it's said we have to love our brethren and sisters, not like them. That, I believe, is rubbish. You cannot love without liking. It's necessary. So we have to contemplate this manner of love. And it is to obey commandments. In the Epistle to the Romans, chapter 13, the Apostle tells us quite simply what love is, and the same principle. In Romans 13 and verse 10, it says, "Love worketh no ill to his neighbour." And again, you see, we have this word, neighbour. It's an evening study to understand our neighbour. It's not the one we live next door to. It's our brethren and sisters. It's the ones we like or the ones we dislike. It's all. Another basis, therefore, we must love. Love worketh no ill to his neighbour. Therefore, love is fulfilling the law. A beautiful little three-letter word. Law. Let's remember it. It runs through our chapter time and time again. It's implied continuously. Every time you see the word love, you could almost transfer it for the word law. Because that's how we show it. In fulfilling it. In our chapter, therefore, it says, "Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God." The sons of God. When I came to that phrase, my beloved brothers and sisters, I nearly threw it all out of the window and said, there's no point in trying. There is no point in trying in dealing with this chapter. Because that one phrase occurs exactly 10 times. 10 is the number of the righteousness of the law. We can't escape it. It's the controlling influence in our love. It tells us every word. 10 times. 10. It would take us all evening to go from one passage to the other just to understand the context and what it teaches. And all we've got is a short time to deal with the whole thing. It starts in John chapter 1. Now, where else could it start apart from with John? And where else but John chapter 1? And John chapter 1 and verse 12 says, "But as many as receive him, to them he gave power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name." We have to acknowledge and believe on his name. Yah is salvation. And the whole of the law was to bring us to Christ. To understand what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us. Do we come to the principles? Do we take the lessons? The context, of course, is from verse 9. "That was the true light which lighteneth every man that cometh into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name, which were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And that's our understanding. That's love. That's the law evident. The Word made flesh. They tell us that in a process of time of 7 years, there is not one atom left standing of me which was there 7 years ago. We have completely changed. Have we, my beloved brothers and sisters, changed one scrap in the years we've been in the truth? Has it actually made one scrap of difference to us? Or are we still the same? Have we allowed it to work upon us like the leaven upon the dough? Has it permeated every corner of us to fill us completely? That we become almost the reflection of him, this Word made flesh, that we may be called the sons of God. The last time it occurs is in the first epistle of John. The first epistle of John in chapter 5, so we will only make the quotation of the verse, that's someone else's subject. 1 John 5 and verse 2 says, "By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep his commandments." And you can't escape the law. Whether we like it or not, we may not, my brothers and sisters, day by day slit the throats of animals. But we have to keep it in every jot and tittle in its spiritual teaching, because it brings us to Christ, and it is our manifestation of love because we keep it. For the remainder of our time together, we've very quickly got to go through the rest of the chapter, having made that as an introduction, and the principles upon which we want to understand it and believe. How do we then, my beloved brothers and sisters, deal with the rest of the chapter? Well, we want to try to find out how we can manifest this fact that we are sons of God. In verse 10 of a chapter, it records for us, "In this the children of God are manifest, and the children of the devil." So we can be one or the other. Either the children of God or the children of the devil. So how do we make the difference? "Whosoever doeth not righteousness is not of God, neither he that loveth not his brother." We can't escape it. If you're going to be the children of God, you keep the law. And that is manifested in loving the brethren in the same way as he loved us. The only alternative is to be one of the children of the devil. And I know which one I want to be. So we need to strive to fulfill it. Verse 2 of our chapter then. "Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And every man that hath this hope in him purifieth himself, even as he is pure." With the principles that we have, we are brought to our hope. Verse 2 says, "Beloved, beloved, now are we the sons of God." If we go to the Epistle to the Colossians, and chapter 3. We see that hope and the outworkings. Colossians 3 and verse 1, "If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affections on things above, and not on things on the earth. For we are dead, and your life, for ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God." When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall we also appear with him in glory. The corollary, the thing that should be in brackets, is quite simple. If you're the sons of God, if you keep the law and show it in loving the brethren, to return that love that has been bestowed upon us so fully and so completely. The way it's done is, the requirement is to purify oneself. Purification is so important, isn't it? In the Gospel of John, in chapter 11, because the principle is purify himself, in John chapter 11 and verse 55, it says, "And the Jews' Passover was nigh at hand, and many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves." And there's your expression, to purify oneself. And they did it by going up to the Passover. What will we, God willing, do tomorrow, my beloved and sisters, apart from going to that memorial which will remind us that Christ, our Passover, was slain for us? That we can take into our hands that word that was made flesh. We can share it, each taking a portion. Just precisely as we're trying to do now. Because not one of you, and myself included, will remember everything that he said. We will take part. And we can take it away and make it part of ourselves. And the fellowship we hold one with the other will keep it as one. Just one faith, one hope, one baptism. It will complete, never divided. Hold it together on the principles of the Passover. But you know, that faith is a waste of time if we don't do something about it. Where is the point of me saying I love you and do nothing? So we have to take the wine as well, don't we? We have to prove our faith by our works. Let's do it sincerely. In the first epistle of Peter, in chapter 1 and verse 22, it says, "Seeing ye have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit unto unfeigned love of the brethren." See that you love one another with a pure heart fervently. Can we escape it? Can we deny that the whole principle of our fellowship is this obedience to commandment and showing that love one for another? Because our chapter continues in verse 4, says, "Whosoever committeth sin transgresseth also the law. For sin is the transgression of the law." I have seen many interpretations, many attempts to explain what the apostle was saying. And I'm no more intelligent than anyone else. All I can do, my beloved and sisters, is share with you the conclusions I've drawn from looking at what it says. and it does not say what's in the AV. What we have to understand is it starts off with the word pass. Whosoever is the Greek word pass. That means all. Individually and collectively. All of us. As individuals and as a body. So all. It then says committed. It says all committeth sin. Committeth is the word boio, and it means to do or to practice sin. Also, so it's whosoever practices sin also transgresses the law. The word also is kai, and it means and. So there are two things. There's one and another. And the second one is transgresses. So what we have to understand is that they commit sin, and in that they transgress. Transgresses. First, I can see there are two Greek words here translated for one word, English transgress. It's the word poio and anomia. Poio is this one to do or to practice. So it's those that sin and practice anomina. Anomina. What does anomia, sorry, mean? Well, it's translated as iniquity. It comes at the end of the verse where it says, for sin is the transgression of the law. And that expression, transgression of the law, is this one Greek word. Anomia. Iniquity. So what have we got, my beloved and sisters? What are we being told? Well, if anyone should understand, we should understand today. We should understand today because we have gone through an experience. An experience that has been called the atonement issue. And we have to understand that sin is in two forms. It's our nature, and it is transgression. And here he says quite simply, that all that practice our nature, and also exhibit in their lives that nature, that we actually break it. And anoia actually means no law. It doesn't mean they're outside of law. It means that they are lawless. They break it at their will. So think of our situation. We're talking about those people who have not changed their nature. They have not been any different at all and practice sin. They practice transgression willfully. And they're not outside. They're in here. They are part of us. Can we therefore understand how important this love is, that we actually exhibit one to another the greatness of the love, where we exhibit the law one to another to show one another the error of our ways? It's there for us to take it. Verse 5 says, And ye know that he was manifested to take away our sins, and in him is no sin. It's perfectly obvious, isn't it, my beloved and sisters, that he never transgressed. He was never lawless. So the only thing he could have had as a problem was his nature. So what he's talking to us quite simply is that that nature has now been dealt with. Hebrews chapter 9. And verse 8 says, so Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many, and unto them that look for him the second to appear the second time without sin. I can't be without transgression because he never had any. So if he's going to come without any form of sin, it must be without that nature. And he will come without sin unto salvation. He has brought us this hope. In verse 6 of our chapter it says, "Whosoever abideth in him sinneth not. Whosoever sinneth hath not seen him, neither known him." How can that be, my brothers and sisters? Because we all sin. Well, it must be on the basis of Romans chapter 6. For Romans chapter 6 and verse 7 says, "For he that is dead is freed from sin." Do you honestly believe the apostle is saying that all you have to do to be freed from death is die? It is for nature. And it has said that we have been baptized into his death. On that basis, therefore, we sin no more. You can't sin, can you? It is impossible. But it's not impossible for you to transgress. He has opened the way for us to enter into life. He has put us in a position where the only thing we have to answer for at judgment seat is not what we are, but what we have done. And it is the forgiveness of transgression that matters. Our chapter then brings us to the consideration of verse 7. Verse 7 starts off with the expression, "little children." Technion occurs just 9 times. The number of finality. This is what we're supposed to end as. Little children. Teachable, accepting the authority, and manifesting love one to the other. That's the object of the exercise. 9 times it occurs, 7 times in this first epistle of John, once in his gospel, and then just once outside of John's writing. The occasion it occurs, apart from John, is the Apostle Paul. And in his epistle to the Galatians in chapter 4, is the only occasion I can find this term, technion, little children, outside of John's writings. Galatians 4 and verse 19 says, "My little children." "My little children, of whom I travail in birth again, until Christ be formed in you." And he takes us to the principle of birth. That's what baptism's all about, isn't it? It's a birth. To be born of water. And he travailed continuously. Now you tell me where he was only ever pleasant and kind and understanding. He balanced both the carrot and the stick. He showed his love in fulfilling and executing the law as love. That's how he travailed in birth. Do we? Or do we ignore? Do we sweep it under the carpet? Carpet remains the same colour, but you can see the lumps. And that's precisely what we are, my brothers and sisters. We're just a little bit knobbly, aren't we? Because we don't deal with the issues. In basic understanding, we don't love. You know, there's only one alternative to not loving, and that's hating. Do you hate your brethren? Or do you love them? Back in our chapter then, in verse 7, he continues with that contrast. Little children, let no man deceive you. He that doeth righteousness is righteous, even as he is righteous. I cannot in all my life or anything I think about imagine that Christ would ever sweep anything under the carpet. He would never ever tell a half truth. He would deal with it as it really is. And he went into the temple with a scourge of cords and threw them all out. I shudder, my brothers and sisters, with the idea of him entering into our ecclesias. Will it just be a scourge of cords and throw us all out? Where are we? Do we love? Verse 8 says, he that committeth sin is of the devil, for the devil sinneth from the beginning. For this purpose the Son of God came, was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. And do we read what it says? It's not talking about Hebrews chapter 2, where he came to destroy him that had the power of death. It says in our narrative that he came to destroy the works of the devil. And the word doesn't even mean destroy. The word is used in Matthew chapter 18 and verse 8, and it's talking about loosing. It's talking about loosing the shoe of his foot in John chapter 1. It's freeing something. So he has not come to destroy. He's come to give freedom. He's come to give us the option of forgiveness of transgressions. Not the nature, but the transgressions, the work. So we see that he has brought an option. We can be the sons of God or the children of the devil. You take your choice. We have separated, gone through the waters of baptism, we now have this hope. He has dealt with the cause. Let's deal with the effect. That he may bring the forgiveness that we need. The covering. It's very similar to Revelation 2 and verse 6, where we hate not the Nicolaitans, but the deeds. The works of the Nicolaitans. It's the manifestation. That's the way we live. We have to put it right. Verse 9 says, whosoever is born of God does not commit sin, for his seed remaineth in him, and he cannot sin because he is born of God. And we are born of water and the word. And that seed has been sown in us. So if we are born of God, we commit no sin. We don't practice our nature. We fall continuously. But we don't glory in that nature. We are not sinners. But we can easily be lawless. Willful in our disobedience. He teaches us this idea. And the contrast comes in verse 10 where he says, in this the children of God are manifest, and the children of the devil. Whosoever doeth not righteousness is not of God, neither he that loveth not his brother. And there's the difference. The seed, these children of God and the children of the devil. In Romans chapter 9, it parallels the children of God with the children of the flesh. So the children of the devil are the children of the flesh. We haven't changed. And therefore can be the children of the devil, unless we try. Verse 11 says, for this is the message that ye have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Not as Cain, who was of that wicked one, and slew his brother. And wherefore slew he him? Because his own works were evil, and his brother's righteous. The children of the wicked. Are we, my brothers and sisters, in that state? Or do we walk as faithfully as we can? Cain, example of the wicked one. Again, I can't understand the translators. Why do you take an adjective and make it a noun? They were children of wickedness, not of a person. It was their characteristics. It's the same as the devil, isn't it? Because the devil is an adjective as well, not a noun. It describes our state, not who we are. So, do we follow the lesson? Cain was of that wicked one. You know, there is a summary of God's love. It's in John chapter 3. John chapter 3 and verse 16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but the world through him might be saved. The word for world there is cosmos. Cosmos. The normal word for world, more often than not in the scripture of the New Testament. Do you remember, my beloved and sisters, where we started in our chapter? In John Epistle and chapter 3 and verse 1, behold what manner of love hath the Father bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. Therefore the world knoweth us not, because it knew him not. And the world is the cosmos. God willing, very shortly, we shall start a second address. That second address will start in verse 13. Verse 13 says to you, marvel not, my brethren, if the world hates you. That's the subject we have to consider shortly. Do we, my beloved and sisters, really understand what it talks about when it talks of cosmos? We shall shortly, God willing, find out.